All right, ready to rock and roll?
Yep.
All right, let's do this. This is Canopy Conversations, where we take you behind the scenes at Canopy and share insights from our team. I'm your host, Eric Schwartz. In this episode, I'm pleased to welcome the other president with an office on Pennsylvania Avenue for our final episode of season one. Ladies and gentlemen, Canopy's very own Walker Forehand, president and general partner of Canopy Ventures.
Honored to be
president,
here. Honored to be here, Eric. You know, first, let me just start by saying that I don't take any offense to the fact that you've done podcasts with pretty much every single other person at Canopy before you got to me. You know, I'm sure you were just having a hard time scheduling with me, and it doesn't say anything at all about the content or the value of what we're going to talk about today.
It does not, and I'd like to counter by saying, you know, podcasting is new to a lot of us here at Canopy. I wanted to make sure that I was so well practiced by the time we had a chance to sit down with you. Cut my teeth with Gene and Chip very early days, episodes 1 and 2. And by now, 6 or 7 episodes in, I think we finally figured this thing out.
Yeah, only downhill from here. You started
exactly
with the best,
right?
And you're ending with the worst.
That is your words, not mine. All right. So, you know, typically we kick off these podcasts with a little bit of a resume walk to figure out, like, how'd you get from where you were to where you are now? But let's do a little twist on that. I want to talk about your first job. So tell us what you did, and if you can tie it in with some of the skills or lessons you took away from that, how did that help you be your professional and now general partner at a venture fund?
Well, my first job was when I was 13, and my friend Ryan Law's dad owned a chemical storage plant in Portsmouth, Virginia, which is kind of in the Norfolk, Virginia area, and hired Ryan and me, and we spent an entire summer painting these, giant methanol tanks, making, I think, $6.50 or $7 an hour at the time. It was very glamorous work. let me say that we, had a lot of fun while we were doing it though, because we would get on top of these tanks, which are very close to the Norfolk International Airport. And we would paint, messages or pictures on top of them, which our bosses at the time didn't know about. So we painted a big smiley face on one methanol tank, and we painted "Hi, y'all" on the second. And for at least 10 or 15 years after, both of those creative expressions that we came up with stayed in place. So that was really my lasting legacy at the methanol plant. But one of the lessons I think I took away from that summer was, doing the little things right and just trying anything I could to learn the value of having a job, earning money, saving money. I ended up wrecking my car a couple years later, and the money that I had saved from that first summer helped to pay for it, because my parents were obviously not going to pay for it. And I ended up having to do a telemarketing job to make up the difference several years later, selling Reader's Digest to senior citizens, and I shattered like their single sales day record. And so that also gave me a lot of appreciation for the cold calling, which we do so often here with companies at Canopy.
I did not know about the Reader's Digest story. That's incredible. You've come a long way since painting methanol tanks and being a telemarketer, which obviously is a very highly transferable skill. Pretty impressive. Just kind of wondering about the OSHA implications of having 13-year-olds climbing up on methanol tanks.
I was working illegally at the time.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure the statute of limitations is well gone by now. We won't tell anyone. So listen, so after this incredible experience growing up in the Norfolk area, Virginia Beach area, you went off to UVA. You spent your career investing in banks, advising banks, and then at first being an angel investor in a number of financial technology firms. How did the leap from that experience work, from you kind of doing it on the side, angel investing and private company investing and public company investing, into Canopy and the fund investing that we do here?
Yeah, so right out of school, I went to work for a guy by the name of Eric Hovde, who was a bank investment banker and investor in community banks, who had launched a hedge fund essentially for investing in publicly traded bank and other financial services companies. I had worked previously as an intern at a long only RIA and was mentored briefly by a guy who was very deep in FIG analysis, bank analysis, and so he taught me just enough to for me to be able to get the job at the time. But I ended up learning a whole lot throughout the experience working with Eric Hovde at Hovde Capital. Really going into the financial crisis, we were positioned massively net short in banks and housing. And I thought it was kind of crazy. I didn't even know what a short was when I took that job, to be completely honest. And then, of course, everything happened with the financial crisis. The fund did amazingly well. We were one of the top, 1% performing hedge funds in the US at the time and were interviewed for The Big Short, the book by Michael Lewis. But it was also deeply unsatisfying. There was something that I just loathed about profiting when the American economy and American families were in the ditch. And I knew immediately that that type of contrarian, counter-cyclical investing it was really not going to be the type of investing I wanted to do. While also at Hovde, I was very involved in working with the team there on buying failed banks all over the country, and probably went and visited 200 or 300 different distressed and failing banks over the course of 3 years. We ended up doing a number of transactions, both inside of the FDIC resolution process and outside. And, we ended up doing quite well financially. But I also found that to be deeply unsatisfying in many respects, not because of the people I was working with or anything like that, but just distressed investing is a particular skill set. It's kind of the exact opposite of what we're doing now and looking at creating jobs and backing, providing capital to back entrepreneurs to really grow and expand and become really meaningful companies. And it's also quite tied to interest rate and credit cycles. So you can be a really great distressed bank investor for 2, 3, 4 years and then not have anything to do for 10 years, basically, which we saw. Pretty much that was the last time before we had a lot of real interesting bank distressed investment opportunities until 2023, when you had SVB and a number of other, high profile bank failures. So when Gene Ludwig called out of nowhere, seemingly in 2010 or 2011, and offered me the opportunity to work with you, Eric, and with BJ and other of our Promontory colleagues, at first I thought, well, gosh, I'm not sure going to work for a high-end regulatory consulting outfit is exactly what I envision as my next step. But I was very intrigued by the growth that Promontory had had and the fit that they had in terms of selling their products and services at a time when they, the banking industry really needed it. So not only did I think the business would grow and perform well, I thought that we would also be doing some good for the banking industry, which of course, the two of us and many, many others at Promontory did under Gene's leadership. After coming into Promontory and getting the chance to work with Gene and Alfred Moses, one of Promontory's other senior executives and founders, it became obvious that I had a skill set that was a bit different than many others in the firm. Many, many other talented folks typically were not coming from investment backgrounds. So, and I was continuing to be very interested in the investing side. So, started looking at different investment opportunities with Gene and with you and with Alfred and others. And was very fortunate to get to know Chip Mahan and Neil Underwood, our co-founders and colleagues here at Canopy. When they were getting started at Live Oak Bank, and had the chance to be invited down with Chip to see Live Oak, and at the time when they were building nCino, and it was immediately obvious to me because of the experience I had going and visiting hundreds of banks all over the country that were distressed, and doing loan file review in these rooms with papers stacked from the floor to the ceiling, that what they had built at nCino, which is this cloud native LOS built on force.com, where they invited the regulators in to do credit review, and they just gave them a login and told them to sit down at the computer. And I thought that was just remarkable. So it was really early on in the cloud days. And of course, you know, the rest is history. And nCino became one of the most important bank tech companies created over the last 10 or 15 years. Now it's publicly traded, used by hundreds of banks, not only here in the US and around the world. And that gave me a real taste for kind of this revolution that was happening in the financial services and bank tech world at the time, really enabled by cloud and many other sort of technological shifts that had happened coming kind of out of the 2008 financial crisis. And we were also fortunate, Eric, to see lots of interesting startups when we were at Promontory. You know, companies like Coinbase, who had come to Promontory for help with financial controls and systems work, and also helping to navigate Washington. We were fortunate to be early investors in those companies when they were private. And obviously, Coinbase has gone on to become one of the largest publicly traded fintechs created over the last decade. So I think Promontory was really just in an interesting place where we were both deeply tied into DC and Washington, and also sitting at the intersection of kind of the traditional financial world and the quote unquote, you know, disruptors and new technology companies. And like everything in life, who you surround yourself with and timing and luck make a whole heck of a lot of a difference. And, you know, getting to work with folks like Eric first, and then Gene, and then obviously folks like you and our other colleagues at Promontory was a big part of how I found myself here today.
That, and of course, sharing an office for a couple of years, formative period in both of our lives.
Yeah, I mean, I still feel like we kind of share an office, even though there's a wall between us, because I bother you so much during the day.
I love the fact we've been working together for on and off for 12 plus years, and we still can't get out of each other's personal space. So, changing gears for just a minute and kind of focusing more so on the investment process. We talk a lot about sourcing and winning deals, how important that is, our unfair advantage with the alliance of 70 plus financial institutions backing Canopy. How does our team help and support companies after the investment? Capital's one thing, but when you think about making investment and when you're talking with prospective companies about taking our capital, what gets them excited? And maybe even, you know, another step further, take us in the boardroom. You're on a number of our portfolio company boards. What type of advice do you see yourself providing and our other partners providing to our portfolio companies?
You know, that was like four different questions, but I'll try to.
Compound question, baby.
You're testing my short-term memory. Well, one of the first things that I always say to founders when we are getting to know each other, sometimes they know a little bit about Canopy, other times they don't. But I think one of the first principles is what I call the Hippocratic Oath of investing. First, do no harm. You know, we approach our relationship with founders from a place of humility, with an open mind, and with a tremendous amount of respect for their experiences, their know-how, their knowledge, and, you know, quite frankly, their courage in doing something which is always a little crazy, which is starting a new company in an incredibly competitive market where the odds seemingly are always stacked against you. And so, you know, I've had a lot of experiences in my career with other really talented and great investors in companies with us. And most of the time, those folks are incredibly value added and polite and of like mind. But there are many, many examples where folks on the investing side tend to come into companies with very strong egos. Oftentimes, but not always, a lot of times they've had a lot of operational success as founders previously, and have a very specific view of what works and what does not, in part formed by their own experience as operators. And I think we try to keep a very open mind, always bring best practices and lessons learned and critical challenge. But you know, also being very respectful for the cultures and the teams that people have put together. So that's one first thing. I think we operate also, as you know, Eric, with a great degree of teamwork here at Canopy. As a newer manager relative to the established private equity and venture capital funds in New York and San Francisco and other places, we really are focused on bringing the best of Canopy to every single founder. And, that might mean that I'm the partner on the board, but I'm regularly bringing in Neil, who has a huge amount of experience running very large sales teams, to be our subject matter expert working with founders or our chief revenue officers about, how to set up their go-to-market operations, how to comp their salespeople, what worked at nCino and many of the other, companies where Neil was intimately involved. And so I think that goes to sort of this low ego approach, which is who is the best on the team to help our founders with the right quarterback. Sometimes that's me, sometimes that's you, Eric. I spend time working with other founders in our portfolio. So that teamwork approach, I think, is best for founders, and in terms of, outcomes. And it's also a lot of fun. We spend so much time with our colleagues and working professionally. But it's really neat to feel like you're on a team of really smart, diverse people that have your back, that you can bring into relationships without any worry of, whose company is this? In fact, they're all of our companies. All of our incentives are set up such that my companies, the ones that I'm on the board of, matter the same as the companies that Neil or Jeff or Tom or others are responsible for overseeing. The third thing I would say is we are, I think, very good as a firm about the go-to-market business development support that we provide. Part of that is our model, obviously being backed by 70 banks and other strategic investors, but also just our focus on the people here at Canopy with you and your team, Eric, with Keenan and Emily and Danielle and others. So we spend quite a bit of time trying to help open doors for our portfolio companies. I was just on the phone with one of our largest bank LPs, I will not be named. And one of our portfolio companies was in a contract renewal with that LP, came in with a big price increase, kind of in some ways bungled it, as best I can tell. And, I've been spending, an hour or two this morning, kind of as lack of a better word, a mediator to get that relationship back on track and, counseling the company to kind of go hat in hand back to our investor and say, yeah, we kind of screwed this up for, legitimate reasons. And it was certainly unintentional. And being that kind of back channel communication between our LP base and our portfolio companies, I think we tend to spend a lot of time on that, which is a little different than other funds. Thanks to Danielle's great work, I think we've had a huge impact on the people side of the business. Danielle, for those who don't know, runs our talent and people work, working with our portfolio companies on any number of HR issues, recruiting, comp design, therapy sessions at times. I think those two main areas, go to market and talent people are, the obvious areas. But when you combine that with our sort of LP network and our deep subject matter expertise, I think we're, pretty differentiated from others in the market.
So we talked about how we go through the investment support post-investment. Obviously, the investing landscape has evolved since we launched Fund One, launched Fund Two, about a year and a half or so ago. How has our investment philosophy evolved over the past year or two as we're deploying Fund Two and as you think about early and late stage opportunities?
Yeah. So I think there's a couple things that I would say before answering that. I mean, the first is your investment strategy is always evolving and always being tweaked in light of new information about business models, technology shifts, market developments, but fundamentally remains largely the same from when we started Canopy, which is backing unbelievably bright and perseverant founders who are trying to make a real difference in the world of financial services, more often than not, building for at least in part or in whole the bank market. And you know, folks who have tremendous sense of ethics, folks who have tremendous work ethics, and like Chip Mahan always says, treat every customer like the only customer, which is the way that we try to operate here at Canapi. In terms of what has changed, I'd say when we first started Canapi, you know, you can't pick exactly what market environment you're launching into. And we launched into very quickly one of the, you know, more volatile and euphoric states for venture capital that we've seen, you know, in decades. The amount of money that had been raised in 19, 20, 21, the types of business models that were being funded, the prices that were being paid, and really the market rewarding growth at any cost relative to traditional expectations around capital efficiency. That has clearly changed across the market since the, you know, 2021, and then kind of the tech rebalancing and the ZIRP end in 22 and 23. The obvious exception to that is anything that's considered to be true AI, which is, you know, generally trading and being you know, valued at levels that harken back to, you know, the earliest days of Canapi. So I think where we've have focused more in the last several years is in a more rational environment. I think founders have gotten a lot more efficient. They understand that the cost of capital has gone up relative to, you know, the early years of this decade. And I think our companies are stronger for it. And I think the investments that we're making today look and feel in some ways different than some of the investments we made in Fund One. Ways that we've evolved and changed. I think as we have spent so much time with our strategic LPs, we came to realize that our banks and other strategic investors were not just looking always for what we would consider to be pure fintech companies, payment companies, deposit, you know, lending, things of that wealth management, things of that are obviously considered fintech in the way that the market thinks of the category, but increasingly looking for ideas, thought partnership, and introductions to companies that are in more horizontal categories where banks and other financial services companies are clearly customers of those technologies, but not the only customers. Cybersecurity is one of the most obvious areas or examples of that. Banks are among the most sophisticated and largest buyers of cyber solutions in the world, just given the sensitivity of customer data and money itself. We run a CISO council that, as you know, Eric, from amongst our banks. And so we've been increasingly active in that part of the world, just given that we think that there's a huge tailwind behind cyber. The problem's not going away. Our banks are big buyers. And oh, by the way, we get to invest in companies that are growing within banking, but also in these other areas of the economy with bigger TAMs and so forth. So cyber is an example of that. A lot of the development tools, data infrastructure tools. We've been spending some time around legal tech because our banks have Office of General Counsel with lawyers who need to be more effective and efficient in the way that they use new tools and technologies that are evolving with you know, this next generation of AI. So I think broadening a bit outside of fintech, where it's still highly relevant to, you know, our strategic LPs and our mandate is one way that the strategy has evolved. And I'd also say that we are spending more time relative to Fund One on investing at the earliest stages of companies. So we've been more active as seed investors in Fund Two and building a larger portfolio of early stage bets where we think we can get more money to work over time as they scale and need improve out product market fit, but also to buy larger stakes in these businesses earlier for better prices. Those are two areas that I would mention.
Appreciate it. We've spent most of the conversation talking about where we've been. Let's talk about where we're going, and would love to hear your vision for Canapi over the next 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, so in the earliest days of Canapi, when we would sort of talk about these things, a lot of times I was the the negative Nelly in the room saying, let's just get one in a row, right? Before we talk about 5 and 10 years down the road. And there's always a piece of me that feels that way, which is, we've got this amazing opportunity. We're managing a lot of money with dry powder right now that needs to be productively deployed, and our 30 portfolio company needs to be carefully managed and overseen. And we have a lot of work to do to make all of these companies successful and to, of course, drive toward our mission of making our banks smarter, better, and getting a lot of strategic value from their investment and partnership with us. Having said all of that, I think the opportunities for Canopy over the long run are, multiple. I mean, the first is, I think our mission is to be the best B2B fintech and enterprise software investors in the world for our strategy. And that will always be our mission while delivering very, very high quality, differentiated, relationship-based strategic value to our LPs. So, oftentimes I hear coaches of sports teams saying, don't remember, make the core thing the core thing. And so that applies here and I think guides a lot of our actions. In terms of areas where we've been looking to expand or do, things differently over time, we have always been intrigued by this theory of verticality where, we learned a lot from Live Oak Bank. Of course, you started with, lending to vets and funeral home operators and dentists, and over time that's grown to dozens of different verticals with deep subject matter experts in each vertical. So I think the same can apply with software and in investing, where, are there other verticals that make sense for us to use our, shared infrastructure here at Canopy to pursue those opportunities, and starting with ones that have particularly high relevance or, overlap with financial services. One of those areas that, as you know, Eric, is healthcare, where we've been spending some amount of time thinking about the intersection of fintech and healthcare, and see quite a bit of deal flow that touches on financial services and healthcare. But the core team, the original team at Canopy, are not deep healthcare folks. So we have brought on a few folks on the team who are deeply focused on healthcare and are evaluating whether there is an opportunity to combine the strategic LPs, or some of them from the Canopy funds, with strategic LPs in the healthcare world, where we can replicate some of the strategic and financial, success that we've had so far on the fintech side. So I think there is an opportunity for vertical expansion over the long run, but I want to be very clear in saying I think that needs to be done like very carefully, very thoughtfully, with very much a focus on our core business being the core business, and doing a very small number of things really well is generally my philosophy.
Love the focus, and it harkens back to what you were talking about, your first job and where details matter, and really focusing on that. Let's end on a fun one. So we've got Neil, Jeff, and Tom. Who are you taking to karaoke? Who are you taking to trivia night? And who are you taking on a cross-country road trip?
Oh, this is easy. So I'm taking Jeff to trivia night for sure.
100%.
Jeff, he's the brain. Very, very smart. Knows a lot about a lot of things. Would probably beat me soundly at trivia. So that one's easy. Who am I taking to karaoke? This one's tough because I think Neil would be more fun than Tom at karaoke. But after seeing his performance of Taylor Swift Love Story at our holiday party, Tom actually showed me something. So I'm going to take Tom to karaoke because it makes me very happy to see him squirm and to see him be uncomfortable. And he actually showed me some talent. So he's earned the right to karaoke. And then I'd take Neil on the road trip because Neil and I are obviously very close and good professional and personal friends. But the idea of Neil on a cross-country road trip is hilarious in and of itself. So I think it would be a growing opportunity for Neil. And again, just the sadistic part of me would love to just see Neil squirm in the car for an entire trip across the country.
Yeah, I think we got to arm you with a GoPro and we can make that season three of Canopy
That's a great
Conversations.
question.
Neil and Walker and a lot of windshield time.
Exactly.
Well, Walker, thanks for taking the time to sit down with us in the audience. We really appreciate it and look forward to many more conversations.
Eric, you're the man. Thanks so much.
Was there anything else you did want to talk about, or things that you did want to talk about that wasn't on the list?
We can talk about whatever you like, Eric.
Well, you better watch out, because we're going to go deep on the UFO phenomenon. Actually, they're not even UFOs, unidentified
Aerial phenomenon.
UAFs. Why are they UAFs? Like, what happened? Like,
UAPs.
UAPs. So, right.
Phenomenon is spelled with a P, Eric. Just not sure if you knew that.
Yes, this is true. Thank you for calling me out on that one. Did the UAP start identifying as such, and therefore we couldn't call them UFOs anymore? What changed?
I think UFO is a scary term. And so the government had to come up with something better to describe it without calling them UFOs. I think that's really what happened.
Phenomenon spelled with an F is pretty damn scary, by the way.
It is. It's scary for other reasons, yes.
Canopy Conversations is confidential and may not be relied upon as investment, legal, or tax advice. Please carefully review Canopy Connect terms and conditions for further information.